This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you're looking for evidence of America as a melting pot, all you have to do is look into the pot, or the pan, or the oven. The evidence is in our food. For if American food is anything, it is the product of all the foods and ingredients and recipes brought here from elsewhere by immigrants. The Italians, the Greeks, the French, the Hispanics, Asians, all those and more have left their imprint on American food. But those different influences can be felt to greater or lesser degrees, depending upon where in the country you are. Well, former New York Times food writer Molly O'Neill has been traveling around the country to dine with people in different regions who cook different foods. The result is an enormous book. I was going to drop it on the desk, but it'll make too much noise. It's called One Big Table, A Portrait of American Cooking, 600 recipes from the nation's best home cooks, farmers, fishermen, pitmasters, and chefs. And she joins us for the hour to share some of what she has discovered. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you with us. Molly has brought with her one of the people who has been traveling with her, Dan Huntley, who is the co-author of a barbecue book called Smoke, a couple of other books as well, and is the founder of Outdoor Feasts Catering Company. He was also a reporter and columnist for the Charlotte Observer for 25 years. You've been on this program before by phone.
You are, right.
Yeah, so welcome back.
Good to be here today, Mike.
Nice to have you with us. And all of this was put together today by our chef on assignment from Johnson & Wales University, master baker, bon vivant, pizza expert, Peter Reinhardt. Welcome back.
Good Thanks, Mike. Again. Great to be back.
All this talk about American food being part of a melting pot, you say that really is not an appropriate analogy, Molly. Why not?
Well, it's a traditional analogy. Immigrants would arrive here, and the impulse was to become part of America. And so that everything went into one pot, and it was this great sort of icon of democracy. But what was a big wake-up call for me was that as I traveled around America, that's no longer true. We've seen this massive exurbanization of immigrant groups. And so the suburbs are full of little teeny-weeny enclaves and church parishes and so on and so forth of you know, there's a group of Vietnamese over there, there's an Iranian here, there's an Indian there. And rather than being a melting pot, we're much more a tossed salad, you know? We're moving on. We started with soup, we've moved to salad. I don't know, what do you think will come next, Peter? Bread?
Bread.
I love the idea of one big loaf, yes.
Yeah.
Well, what you described is exactly what we have here. We have Vietnamese enclaves, Hmong enclaves. We have people from all over the world in different areas, and their restaurants are cropping up.
Right.
Food from those areas
right.
are cropping up as well. This idea for this book, as I understand it, started while you were at the Times and living in New York and dining nightly in some of the world's finest restaurants.
Right.
And the food cosignenti, however you say that word, were saying that people don't cook anymore in America.
You know, that's been the big rap.
Yeah.
And I had done a book called The New York Cookbook, and I actually walked every block of all five boroughs, gathering people's oral histories and their recipes and going to church suppers and doing this, that, and the other thing. And I knew as soon as I finished that book that I wanted to do the same thing for America, but I had a problem. There was no way I could walk America. And I kept hearing, you know, the sort of food elite media saying, you know, cooking's dead. Nobody cooks. Nobody cooks. Nobody cooks. But when I was drilling down into it, that's not the truth. I mean, America, there are still home kitchens. There are still grocery stores. People are still buying pots and pans. Somebody's cooking. So who's cooking?
And somebody, was it you that said this or somebody else said this? The more expensive the range in your
right.
kitchen, the less cooking you do.
I did a story for the New Yorker magazine and did sort of an informal survey of people who bought Viking, Wolf, and Aga ranges. And what I found is that these huge investments really were temples to the best intentions, but they generally got used once or twice a year, like Thanksgiving dinner.
Right.
I need that great big oven. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, people are eating out. People are bringing in. They're not those particular, that particular demographic is not cooking as much at home.
But when you get out of the middle of Manhattan, you found that people are, in fact.
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, but, you know, I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and I couldn't wait to get out of that place. But I could go back and live in Columbus, Ohio today. It is a beautiful sort of mosaic, very alive ethnically, very alive culturally. Everything that was not there when I was growing up. I mean, at Whetstone High School, here was our diversity. There was an African American guy named Dwight who was the major drum player in the marching band, mm-hmm. and Paul and Lisa Greenbaum. That was it. Okay.
But that's changed.
Well, it's changed. You know, when I was visiting my mother, while I was doing this book, she insisted that we go have a manicure because I had to do a TV thing and they look at your hands. So we went to her manicurist, who is this woman named Kim, and Kim starts telling me her story. And Kim's parents had been Vietnamese boat people. And they took their older children and youngest children, and they left the middle children, Kim and two sisters. And the family was assumed dead for 10 years, and finally they resurfaced, and they had gotten to America. They'd gotten sponsored by a church in Columbus and were living in Columbus. Mm-hmm. They finally brought Kim there. The first thing they did was take her to Kroger's. I don't know if you've been in the Midwest, but Kroger's is it. It's the world.
We used to have Kroger here.
And
Harris Teeter drove them out.
and Kim walked into Kroger. She hadn't seen this much food in her entire life in one place. They went home and they made pho, the sort of Vietnamese ritual, wonderful beefy dish. But pho had just been this sort of brown broth with a little meat in it when she was growing up in Vietnam. Now in Columbus, it's short ribs, it's meatballs, it's stewing beef, it's chuck, it's got shrimp, it's got all these herbs, all these vegetables. The whole, it's an explosion. It's a continent in a bowl. That's what pho has become. It's the Vietnamese idea with an American, a celebration of plenty and of survival and of joy and of time and all of these things. So as she tells the story, and this was one of those moments when you're doing a long book project, you have these few light bulbs that go off. So she's painting my nails and telling me about, well, you know, my girls could not wait to get to Vietnam because every Sunday I make pho. Her girls go to a very ritzy private school, but she wants them to remember where they came from. They love pho. So she takes them back to Vietnam. Oh my gosh, they can't wait to get to the pho. And they're eating the pho, spitting it out, crying, freaking out. They can't wait to get home and have a real pho.
So that is that a microcosm of what has happened to food as immigrants come here to this country and they try to preserve their traditions? They altered their traditions to reflect America.
They altered their traditions are altered. Any cuisine that is alive is changing.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not, you're eating museum food. And who wants that? I mean, maybe once. But not day after day
right.
after day.
So what then is American food? Is there any such thing as American food?
You know, you guys, don't you think we're getting closer? I mean, I think we're in process. It's a cuisine that is discovering itself. And after 10 years on the road, I felt like we're getting closer. The salad right. is getting us closer to the main course.
And you also point out in this book that even though we haven't been known, Europeans would come here and say that Americans don't know how to cook. They don't know how to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are an immigrant country and we are a frontier country. And people who are busy clearing trees and conquering a continent are not going to spend a lot of time on sauces.
Well, yeah, you're not going to make a béarnaise when you're fighting
right.
a grizzly bear.
Right. So we've begun to incorporate all of this now that we have become settled.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken a
mm-hmm.
long time, hasn't it?
So much has changed in the last 10, 15 years. And I mean, it's been a quantum leap, not just a gradual evolution to arrive at this new sort of culinary mm-hmm. level that we're at now. So, yeah, in one sense, we're catching up. And in another sense, as Molly was saying, we're sort of finding our own voice in it. And now other countries kind of look to us.
Right.
I think it was interesting. Back, I used to do a lot of research with cookbooks. And up until the mid-1800s, all of the there were no American cookbooks. I mean, there was no American cuisine. Everything was European. And it wasn't until right before the Civil War you would start seeing these things. And it was like, you know, it's amazing to me that cultural – and then we're at another plateau now. you know, what is American food? That's a great question.
Well, that leads me to you, Dan, and that is you're traveling the country with Molly O'Neill. She's celebrating all these immigrant foods and how they've become changed by American culture and how American culture is being changed by these foods and the fact that people cook at home and they cook these dishes at home. And she's produced this mammoth 600-some-page book. You're a barbecue expert.
Right.
Why are you on this tour?
You know, he
drives well.
Right. I'm the Sherpa book carrier for Molly. You know, it's funny. I was thinking, Mike, 2 weeks ago, we were down in Biloxi, Mississippi. And, you know, when you're foodies and you're traveling, my wife always teases me about the 20-minute rule off the interstate. You can only go 20 minutes in one direction looking for one of these crazy ethnic food places because, one, you know, I've got my map wrong. Two, the place is closed. It's changed. And we went to this place, a French-Vietnamese bakery.
Oh,
and it
wow.
was, we were getting ready to
Biloxi,
leave.
Biloxi, Mississippi.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Okay. And we go in there and, you know, I mean, Biloxi.
Yeah.
And we had just, seen a thing. I think, what is it? The Serbs have a Serbian social club
right,
there.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
And the Vietnamese who do most of the, all of the commercial fishing there, they had lost their social club. So the Vietnamese were meeting in the Serbian social club. And we had heard about this, so we just drop into the bakery, and we're the only people there.
Le bakery.
Le bakery. And they had the most incredible stuff there, that pastry that they had stuffed with some sort of...
We had a pork. Meat pie.
Oh,
it,
yeah.
It was a little meat pie, but they'd used puff pastry.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. It was so delicious. And the woman who made it was there, and so immediately I'm... practically on top of her. Now, how did you do this? And the owner of the bakery, who's this young Vietnamese woman and very kind of street savvy, takes me aside and said, "She ain't going to give it up."
Yeah.
Do they know who you are when you ask them
yeah,
questions?
Yeah, really.
Like this?
Do you know who I am?
No, I'm sure. I don't mean that in that sense. But did they realize that you are traveling the country for this book and that you're a major food writer in the world? I mean, do they understand that?
I did my best to impress them.
but Mike, back to your original question, one of the things that we've ran through, and I've been doing a lot of stuff with Tom Hatchett, at the Levine, and we did his international barbecue tour 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I was telling Molly on the way over here this morning that, you know, you grow up in the Carolinas, you think this is the epicenter of barbecue. And you go to Memphis, you go to Kansas City, and then I went to Istanbul, I went to Buenos Aires, and I began to understand that the Carolinas is not the epicenter of all grilled meat in the world.
Shut your mouth.
And that there is brisket, there is lamb, there's all sorts of stuff. And you know, it's not that North Carolina barbecue is, you know, not the you know granddaddy of all grilled meats. It's good, but it's different, and that's what I love about traveling.
Well, we're going to talk about that and how the what influences what cultural influences influence barbecue as well in this part of the world. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. And Johnson C. Smith University, this Sunday at 4, the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra and JCSU Concert Choir explore the effects of music on the human brain and body. Open to the public, jcsu.edu. Well, after years and years of hard work, Concord's Avett Brothers have hit the national stage, and they played Radio City Music Hall recently, and they've also been on the Letterman Show, etc. But at the same time, one of the members of that band, Scott Avett, the banjo-playing singing member of that band, has been developing another of his talents, visual arts. He's a painter, and his painting has attracted a lot of national attention as well. So Scott Avett will join us to talk about why he paints and what he paints Monday. At 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Leaders of a bipartisan debt panel proposed deep cuts in tax breaks and spending. Write-in votes put incumbent Lisa Murkowski in the lead for Alaska's U.S. Senate seat. And the FDA unveils plans for graphic warnings on cigarette packages.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Molly O'Neill, food writer, author of a brand-new book that has yet to come out. It's coming out when?
The 16th of November.
A fabulous book. I mean, I don't cook, and this book is amazing. It's called One Big Table, A Portrait of American Cooking. She joins us in our Spirit Square studio, along with Dan Huntley, a barbecue expert, caterer, author of Smoke and several other barbecue books. Been on the program before. And, of course, Peter Reinhardt from Johnson & Wales University. The two of you, Molly and Dan, are appearing at several locations in the next several days. Here, we're going to put those locations on our website and on our new food blog, which we're going to talk about later in the program here. And I'm just thrilled to death with this food blog, not because it's about food, but because somebody very cleverly titled it WFA Eats.
Ooh.
I just think that's great. And we'll talk all about that in a couple of seconds. As you went around for this book, collecting recipes and talking to people about the food that they cook in their kitchens at home, you told them that you wanted recipes or food examples that embodied their life and times in their own personal America.
Mm-hmm.
Did that help them choose a recipe to give you, or did it expand the possibilities out to so many things that it was difficult for them to give you recipes?
It depended on the personality. And I often had to follow up that question with, no, no, it's okay, it's okay. If I were your great-granddaughter and you wanted me to have one recipe, what would it be? And then bang. There was almost
really?
No hesitation. But you have to be around somebody for a while, because at first when you're interviewing home cooks, they think, well, I can't cook. You know, she's a food writer. What am I? Well, you have to be in their kitchen and be cooking with them and talking and talking. And then they understand that what they do is valuable.
Did you taste all of these recipes that are in the book?
Well, do I look like I did? Yeah.
And you watched them cook it?
We usually cook together.
So how did you find these people all over the country? These are strangers, perfect strangers.
Well, not once you've eaten together, they're not.
Yeah, but you have to get into their houses and stand with them in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you get in?
Well, you do a number of things. At first, I was collecting recipes. I was still at the New York Times, and I would put calls out for readers' recipes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that as much as I adore it, the New York Times represents a very small band of American experience, and I needed to expand. I made an alliance with the not-for-profit that was then called America's Second Harvest. They've recently rebranded themselves, and they're called Feeding America.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a network of food banks. And with them, I created potluck dinners across America, and it worked like this. You brought a dish and a recipe to me, and I acted like Miss Antique Roadshow, and you'd sit down, and we'd eat a little bit, and we'd talk, and we'd see, you know, is this something that I should test? Is this an interview I should have in more depth? And then they brought a donation of any size to their local food bank, and it went right to the food bank, who would be sitting next to me. And that opened up huge worlds that I would not otherwise have had access to. I mean, I think I gathered about 5,000 recipes that way. Two were in the book, because it led to other people and other recipes. And what people brought to a potluck was not necessarily their best dish.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they got there, they thought, heck, I'm not giving you tuna and noodle. Come on home and I'll make my grandmother's kolache or, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then I worked with churches and ethnic clubs. And finally, I realized I had this perfectly balanced demographic portrait of America, and it was perfectly boring. And I couldn't figure out where I'd gone wrong, because I really had worked hard. And I realized that I'd gone by numbers and that I hadn't followed passions. And so at that point, I put out a call for subcultures and for people who came, chosen communities, So there's a group of African-American self-taught visionary artists who operate. It's a very informal network. These guys live off the grid. The entire family now in the fourth and fifth and sixth generation are making art, and they cook. They cook like you cannot believe. There were a group of weavers in the high plains of New Mexico. They came together because they raised sheep, and they had to figure out what to do. Well, they cook. I mean, these are people who are making their lives with their own hands. Mm-hmm. A number of church groups, a number of sort of modern utopian communities, you know, self-chosen communities, whether it's a suburban community for people over 55 or a community that comes together around a farm and a great progressive kids' school, or a really, really rigorous, traditional sort of Christian school, you know, children's school, where the parents are wanting these children to understand how you eat and what you eat and be self-sufficient. By following those various communities, I was led into a world that was run by heart and by passion. And more than any kind of demography, that's what American cooking is about.
After so many years in New York, running for the Times and living in Manhattan and eating in the great restaurants, when you went out into the hinterlands of America and for this book, did it amaze you, the variety and the little enclaves that you just talked about, the fact that they exist? I mean, did it not just blow your mind?
Well, I mean, I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. And when I was growing up there, Columbus, Ohio was a test market capital for food products for the United States. The feeling was, you know, if you wanted to be in Broadway, if you could play Peoria, you were fine. Well, if you wanted to be in the food industry or the packaged food industry or the fast food industry, if you could make it in Columbus, you were gold.
I didn't know that, yeah.
Yeah.
Columbus is sort of like the true test market, the focus group for American food.
Yeah. And so my brothers and I, who, you know, my parents were very healthy food advocates, and all we weren't allowed to eat packaged food. My father thought it was a communist plot. My mother thought it was, you know, other people ate like that, not us. Mm-hmm. We couldn't wait to get out and test market because it was free. So we could go to a place that became known as Wendy's and try the first fry and try the first burger. We could, you know, my first cooking lesson was learning how to make cheesy manwich buns out of at the Kroger's.
Is that in here?
So, you know, what I was surprised by was that there's a lot of irony. First of all, in New York City now, every single restaurant is from our farm or from our partner farmers, or, you know, it's all farm, farm, farm. Yeah. And in Columbus, it's all cosmopolitan. So it's been this hilarious shift. You know, everything I ran away from is now, you know, New York. And everything that I was looking for is in the suburbs. So there's been, that's a big, big shift.
It's the story of bread, isn't it?
Well,
is it?
From refined flours to
whole grain. Yeah. And now we go back and forth between these things. This sort of interplay of, it's almost ironic how it flows. But what you were describing, we talk about it in our food and culture classes at the university, in terms of pathways, food pathways. And it sounds like, you know, you really kind of latched on to, you know, to just through your own journey, the foods were leading you to the stories, and the stories were leading you to the foods, but the foods start to tell the story. And that's what sounds so fascinating about this journey you've been on. Mm-hmm. It's like 10 years you've been doing this, right?
Yeah, I'm a little slow.
Putting this book.
No, this book is amazing. It's got so many different, I mean, I can't imagine cooking these. And if you cooked every recipe in this book, you literally are dining around the world. I mean, it's just unbelievable what you've got in here.
Yeah, well, you could cook. Dan and I did an event at Ellis Island in New York City last week, and it really was, it was a remarkable thing because there were 10 recipes, and you would, by circling that room, the Great Hall, you were traveling around the world and through time, and it worked. And it came together. It was a very magical evening.
And you did it. That's where 12 million people came to America.
Yeah,
Is that why you chose this to launch this
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was more than a launch. It really was, it was an educational thing, but it was also a celebration of what makes us great.
Oh, yeah, right.
And it worked. I mean, but it worked because of the food.
And it was really fascinating, Mike, getting there to Ellis Island, and you would think about the people, the immigrants coming in there, what they carried with them from their home countries.
Right.
And it was, beside the suitcase, it was the recipes.
And our partner was the National Parks of New York Harbor Conservancy. And a lot of the people who came there, and we were sold out, some of those people had never gone to Ellis before. And it was bad weather, and they were on this ferry, and by the time they stumbled off, it was like they'd just gotten out of steerage. And as they, and then they walked into this majestic space that looked like a dream. And you, I mean, it was almost as if we got to relive a little bit of that experience, that you walk into this space and you know you're safe and that anything is possible. It was very moving. There wasn't, I mean, by the end of the night, we also had some students from Pace University who'd rewritten some American classics. And the final number, we had a panel, we had great discussions. The final number they sang was an African-American kid who had a new, a blues-like take on America the Beautiful. There was not, I was having a major mascara crisis. There was not a dry eye in that house. But it was because of the food. People had gone around this room, and by eating these different flavors and everything, they were able to travel through time and travel around the world. And it made the immigration issue suddenly human and manageable. They weren't policy. It was like, well, this makes us great. You know, what are we talking about?
Peter, this is probably no surprise to you, but every time you bring a food guest on, like Molly O'Neill here, it's amazing to me how passionate they are about what no other guests on any other topic are this passionate. What is it about food and passion?
That's a great question. What is it? What is it about food?
You know, what is it about?
What is it? What is it? Well, you know, I just did some filming for a project I'm working on, and we call it, you know, sort of the subtitle is "The Fire in Their Bellies," and you know that metaphor, that, you know, it's almost become a cliche, but it's so apt because there is something that burns deep within us, and it's so not just related to food as food, but what food represents.
This Ellis Island dinner that you were talking about, which happened in November, is part of a series of events that you have scheduled around the country. I think you did one in August in Lake Wylie. You're doing one later on this week, tomorrow, in Mount Holly. And these dinners use, as I understand it, local farmers market and local farm produce and meats, etc. And it costs to get in, but all the money goes to what?
Well, we do two kinds of events. One are the large Ellis Island sort of events where we're really framing a social issue through food. And the next, you know, for this year and next year, we're really looking at multiculturalism and immigration through food. Now, our other project that we both adore is doing dinners with farmers markets that need help from the outside, that need to do a little fundraising, that need to get a little media attention. And for us, it's just the most magical thing because we get to go in, talk to various farmers, collect food, get the food for free. I get to talk to people and collect recipes. We put together an evening that is a celebration of agriculture and of cultural context. You don't say that, "Hi, welcome to Mount Holly. This is a celebration of cultural context." But it just is, you know? And those dinners are rarely for more than 100 people. I mean, if we had our way, they would be 50 and we'd cap it because then you can have a single conversation.
But how do you do it? I mean, how do you – these are strange communities. You're not part of them. How do you know where to go?
We don't see Mount Holly as being strange.
No, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, you don't live here.
You haven't been there yet.
You don't live here, and you don't live in Xenia, Ohio. So if you go to a place like that, how do you know where to begin? Who do you invite? Who do you invite? Where do you have it? Do you find the farm?
Oh, you have to have a fantastic partner on the ground, and we only do it if there's a great partner. In Mount Holly, a woman named Lee Brinkley is just a true believer, And that woman has created this market and made this market happen against all odds. Mm-hmm. And she had what Peter would call fire in the belly. I mean, she looked at us and nobody could say no. It's like, my God, this woman's a saint. What can we do?
And the trick is, to me, Mike, with these farmers markets, I mean, this summer we went to Yorkmont, and just an incredible diversity. I was just blown away with all the vendors there. And with these markets, and I think they've been like a 15% increase in the number of farmers markets in America in the last year, is that if you don't have the crowds, you don't have the vendors. If you don't have the vendors, you don't have the crowds. To reach that critical mass, and what we're trying to do is go in, and I've been doing these for over the last 2 years. We call them 50 on 50. 50 people, 50 bucks, all the produce from within 50 miles of that table. And it was, you know, kind of an unstructured, you know, thing that I was doing. Started and got up with Molly, and she said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could partner with someone, and we're doing things with the New York Times, National Park Service, a 501(c), and what we want to do is come in and help these markets that are struggling and get them up to a critical mass. They don't need us. You know, one of the things that Molly and I talk about, you know, you don't give them fish. You teach them how to fish. And we want them to do these dinners after we're gone, do it as an annual event. And, you know, we don't make any money from it. All the money stays in the communities. And, you know, if there's people out there, you have a struggling farmers market, contact us.
Yeah.
Are there still seats available for tomorrow night's event?
There are very few seats, but there are a few tickets left.
Tomorrow night would be November 13th, 2010, for those of you who may be listening to this at a later time. barbecue, very quickly, because that's your area of expertise. Mm-hmm. As you said, it's different as you go through different parts of the country.
Right.
Is that because of immigrant influences, or is it because of Native American influences, or is it because of something else?
It's a combination, Mike. I think it's fascinating how regional cuisines develop based on, you know, the availability of, you know, woods. You know, if I tell people all the time, the reason I focus on pork barbecue is I grew up in pig country. You know, I mean, this is what it is. If I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, I'd be smoking salmon, and maybe I'd be calling it barbecue.
It's really, barbecue really means cooking over fire.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's
interesting to note in the, I don't know what you call this part of the book.
Isn't that great?
As you open Molly's book, there's a map of the United States and the food. And if you look at the map of North and South Carolina, the only food you see are pigs.
That map was created in 1903, I think, by the Armour Meat Company. And it says the greatness of the United States is its agriculture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in the map, it's hilarious because that's just when, the industrialization was starting. And they have the farms, but they also have the meat processing centers.
We have to stop. We're coming right back with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Healthy Home Market, a local source for health and special diet food since 1979, hosting a holiday food tasting tomorrow, 1 to 4, at the Davidson location, healthyhomemkt.com. And from Hendrick Acura in Charlotte, introducing the 2011 Acura MDX with a 300-horsepower V6 engine and standard all-wheel drive. An array of financing options, virtual tours, HendrickAcura.com. Coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the weekly news roundup, hour number one. A panel of journalists joins guest host Susan Page to talk about leaders of a bipartisan debt panel proposing deep cuts in tax breaks and spending, write-in votes, putting incumbent Lisa Murkowski in the lead for Alaska's U.S. Senate seat, and the FDA package that unveils graphic warnings on cigarette packages. That's coming up at 10. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE.
WFAE Trivia Night returns to Revolution Pizza and Ale House in Noda on Wednesday, November 17th. play on the WFAE team or compete against our staff for prizes and bragging rights. We'll also collect food and clothing for our neighbors in need. Information is available at WFAE.org. Hope to see you there.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting around the table here at Spirit Square talking with Molly O'Neill, food writer, critic, and the author of a remarkable book, brand new, hasn't come out yet. It comes out later this month, called One Big Table, A Portrait of American Cooking. Dan Huntley is also with us. Let me make a major correction here. Dan's book is called Extreme Barbecue. That's what we talked about when you were on the program before.
Right. Mm-hmm.
His restaurant is called Smoke Southern Barbecue in Blythewood, South Carolina. Does that mean you use mustard?
we have mustard as one of our four sauces there. It's funny when you, I live in York County, and when you drive down, we are on I-77, and just how crazy the food world is. You know, you have maps of barbecue sauces and stuff. When you cross on I-77 down below Rock Hill, you cross what I call the hash line. North of there, where I'm from in York County, Your hash is always beef, and it's done with potatoes and butter. But when you get down around Chester County, and what we do at our restaurant, it's your hash is always made with pork and rice, and it's a rice-based hash all the way to Savannah. And it's really funny. We have particularly older people who come in our restaurant all the time, and it's pit smoked barbecue, but they want hash, and they what you refer to like the mustard based barbecue sauce, and it's funny. You think that, you know, barbecue is barbecue, food is food, but it is very distinctive, and it's the rice culture coming up from the coast.
Which dates back hundreds of years.
Oh, yeah, right.
Peter Reinhardt is also with us from Johnson & Wales University. I just wanted to make sure that people knew that you were here.
I'm here. I'm just fascinated with these stories, and I'm thinking how apt it is that we're having this conversation now, 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, because this really is, we talk about one big table, we talk about the influence of immigrant cultures on our foods and the symbolism of what Thanksgiving's all about, you know, not only the harvest, but the fact that Thanksgiving was probably our first immigrant holiday.
Our first accommodation.
And I'm sure this book will be out just in time for Thanksgiving.
Well, you can get the book here. You can get some. We brought some copies down. So there are copies. There are going to be copies at the Mount Holly Farmers Market dinner.
Right.
And then there are copies at the two events that we're doing signings for.
Right.
And those will be on your website. I believe we're also auctioning off a copy of One Big Table and Extreme Barbecue. This is a magnificent opportunity to give to your local NPR affiliate station. And I believe that there's some possibility of getting two very difficult to obtain seats for the Mount Holly Farmers Dinner as well.
I believe those are the last ones.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll be able to find this
that right in.
You'll be able to
find You've done this before.
You'll be able to find this information on our website and on our new food blog, which we're going to talk about in just a few minutes here. This is more than a cookbook, although there are 600 recipes in here. It's a lot of history. It's a lot of history about the food, about the cultures, and about the individual people whose recipes are in here and why they do what they do. And a lot of photographs that are just wonderful. I don't know. There's a picture of a woman here sitting reading a newspaper. It's probably 1938 or 42, something in there. And she's got a toaster in front, an old-fashioned toaster, and she's holding the toaster cord.
And the
caption is, "The wrong way to disconnect the toaster." She's going to pull it out of the wall like that.
That's from the Library of Congress. I was fortunate enough to have an extraordinary visual collaborator, Rebecca Bucell, who was one of the editors of Aperture magazine and is a photographer and is a writer and, hilariously enough, is also the great-grandniece of Irma Rombauer, The Joy of Cooking.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. So,
wow.
You know, Rebecca and I traveled a lot together, and she took pictures but also curated pictures. The Library of Congress was unbelievably wonderful to us.
You've got, about 1,200 images in this book.
In the book itself, I believe there are 800 images, but we created a gallery of 1,200 images that we own all the rights to, and they're high-res images, and It was as hard as writing the book. Really and truly was. I had no idea. You know, writers didn't used to become involved with photography, but now writers do everything. Or they find somebody like Rebecca.
Do you have a favorite recipe or two, or a surprising recipe that you just had never experienced anything like that particular dish, and you were just thrilled to death to find it?
I mean there are a few in this book, but the one is one that embarrasses me the most is called Holly Lane's Very Best Cookie, and the woman is from Cincinnati, Ohio. And in many of the recipe drives, you get 1,000 recipes and maybe test 50 maximum. There's just a lot. You read them, and, well, that's right out of The Joy of Cooking, 1938. Well, that's from Gourmet Magazine, 1963. People don't know where the recipes came from.
Right.
But our job is to make sure you're not just ripping off somebody else's recipe. And there was this one recipe that it was like cornflake chocolate chip kitchen sink cookie. And I remember reading it and just throwing it into the pile. And one of the test cooks said, you know, this sounds kind of interesting. No, we are not putting convenience products. No, we will not have. No. We have to draw a line in the sand. 2 years later, I'm sitting at my brother's house, Paul, down in Cincinnati. And he brings out of the oven the most extraordinary cookie I have ever tasted in my life. And I'm just going ballistic. This is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And I got to have this recipe. And he said, well, you had it. You rejected it. And it turns out that Holly Lane, unbeknownst to me, is one of my brother's best friends.
Oh.
And these cookies that have everything. I mean, they have cornflakes, oatmeal, chocolate chips, flour, coconut, little bits of Heath bars. The recipe reads like an abomination, and it eats like a dream. It's a fabulous cookie.
You know, Molly mentioned her brother Paul, and some of the listeners may not know, but her brother Paul O'Neill was the all-star outfielder for the New York Yankees for many years.
Oh.
And Molly's written, in addition to this new book, has written a memoir that is fascinating about being the oldest sister of five brothers who were destined to be athletes.
Well, we were fourth generation baseball family. My great grandfather was on the first organized traveling team.
That explains Fenway Chowder and the appearance of Ted Williams in this book. And you tell stories about Ted Williams' legendary association with cuisine.
He was a fantastic cook. And so, I mean, my brothers are all fabulous cooks.
But he used to shock. He liked to shock people with what he served them.
He did like to shock people. I actually visited him down in Florida during spring training 1 year, and we cooked together. He liked to make dishes and then tell people it was cow's eyeballs and things like that. And, you know, he would take things into the clubhouse and other players would eat it. And then he'd say, yeah, it's my favorite Rocky Mountain oysters. they'd freak.
Wasn't.
No, it'd be tenderloin or something like that.
He was punking them.
He was, yes, he was punking them.
Why?
Well, he was just kind of a perverse person, you know. His
guy,
his ambition would. When I said, "What did you want to be when you grew up?" and he said, "I wanted to walk down the street and have people say, 'There goes the greatest hitter that ever lived.'" And it was very moving. I mean, there was nothing egotistical about it. It was somebody saying, "This is the thing I can do, and I want to do it the very best."
So, given the fact that he was a good cook and enjoyed cooking and cooked for a lot of different people, how did you decide upon Fenway Chowder as the recipe to put in this book?
Well, you know, he was a legendary Red Sox player. He loved seafood. He was a great big sport fisherman, and the dish that he was the most proud of was this highly unconventional chowder. And it was a no-brainer. You know, what do you put in of Ted's? Well, not his pizza, you know, though he made a great pizza. But this was a dish that was one of the earliest dishes he perfected, and it followed him throughout his life. And so that's what I wanted. I wanted a recipe that expressed a life.
And then And then there are stories, there's things going, going on behind the scenes that people can't see. It strikes me as humorous. There are stories throughout this book about food products, about the people involved. One of them is this, and it's just, I just happened to be leafing through yesterday, and I thought, what? Cream cheese is not a Philadelphia story.
No, it's not. When cream cheese was invented, it was probably invented in upstate New York, though there are a few competing claims. The upstate New York claim appears to be the most solid. Mm. And it was named Philadelphia because at that time in history, Philadelphia was the epitome of elegance. And this was this smooth, satiny, highly refined cheese. And so, well, what are we going to call it? We're not going to call it upstate New York Neufchâtel.
Right.
You know, we'll call it Philadelphia, and we'll say cream.
I grew up in Philadelphia. I don't remember too many of those elegant places at the time, but we did. We were very proud of having a cream cheese named for us, that's for sure.
Well, you're not that old, Peter.
So along the way, as you assembled these recipes and sat in people's kitchens and watched them cook and shared recipes and decided what you were going to do, you discovered that our fellow citizens can and do cook. Some cook badly. Some cook well. All cook to say who they are and where they came from.
Yeah.
Really?
I think so. It sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does sound good. Of course, you were, but you were seeking out people from different cultures for this, weren't you?
Yeah, I was very targeted.
I've got a question for you about that, Mom.
Yeah.
Because with all the people that you found from other cultures who were bringing in family heirloom recipes, obviously, as you said earlier, these recipes changed and evolved when they came and used local ingredients, mm-hmm. American ingredients, Americanized. What was that like in talking to people? Did they have regrets? Did they have concerns about, you know, the authenticity? And, you know, was that an issue for anybody?
Yeah, I mean, it was, and it's a constant conversation. What's the difference between real fusion and, you know, real yuck?
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between an authentic recipe and, you know, sort of a McDonald's? It comes down to having heart and being really present to what you're doing and being aware of your history and letting it, you know, one guy, Lonnie Hawley down in, Alabama, who's a wonderful, wonderful cook and a visionary artist, said to me, you know, cooking is something you just let move through you and you hope it comes from your heart to your hand.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You clear your pathway and you let it, rip. And I said, well, great. Could I get your chowder recipe? And he nearly fainted.
Very quickly, we have a studio audience here, and I invited people from the audience to ask questions if they had one. So step up to the microphone and have at it.
Hello. I'm Lee Brinkley, and I just wanted to comment about the struggling part of the Mount Holly Farmers Market. That's not really true, but we started from 0 to 5, and we're in year 5. And it's really more about the relationships that we're forming with you, with Dan, with local people in our county, and it's about the relationships that we're reconnecting. So
yeah.
I thought that was important.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. We have to. I've carved out a little piece of the show before we go this hour. We're going to spend a couple of minutes talking about something new with regard to food and Charlotte and WFAE. Today we announce, drumroll, the beginning of a food blog on the pages of WFAE.org. We get so much response and are given so little time to cover food on this program that it's literally impossible for us to cover it all. So this new blog will be a place for a lot of the ideas that we don't get to go to, and an opportunity for you foodies out there to join the conversation. And we're calling the blog WFA Eats, and Elizabeth Schaefer will be the person in charge. She joins us now for a few minutes. Where did this idea, welcome, by the way.
Thank you.
Where did this idea
Thank you.
Come from for this food blog?
The idea has been sort of around WFAE for a while, and it really came from the show here, food topics that we don't get to cover, mm-hmm. and some of the southern, the public conversations that we have. We had one recently about southern food, and it was really well attended, and we thought we just need to have another place to talk about food with our listeners.
So what will the content be
like? The content is varied. It's anything food. We have pulled together a wonderful group of contributors, food writers in the area, and we're leaving it up to them, really.
Really?
What they want to write about, what they're passionate about. It could be anything from Right now we have a spotlight on a local farmers market up, as well as Amy Rogers, a food writer and author,
right.
Has a piece about a Thanksgiving that she attended. Ashley Talley, she's a freelance writer. She wrote a piece about butternut squash, what to do with it, some of her favorite recipes. So it'll be
And
anything.
I'll probably be chiming in from time to time with sort of follow-ups to the shows that
okay.
we do with you,
yeah.
Mike.
In fact, I understand it. You have your own set of questions for Molly O'Neill, and
that
right. interview will appear on the food
That's
blog
right.
as well.
That's right. That will. Molly was so gracious this morning to sit down with me and answer a few quick questions.
Were they good questions, Molly?
Yeah.
Okay.
This girl knows how to write a question.
And we're also, through the weekend, giving away a copy, an autographed copy of Molly's book, One Big Table, and Dan's book, Extreme Barbecue. Mm-hmm. So if you go to the blog, if you go to FAE.org, you'll find a link for the blog and leave us a comment there.
And can listeners get involved? Can they,
Absolutely.
Can, they can make their own contributions to
Absolutely.
The blog?
Absolutely. They can leave comments in the comment fields, and there is a section for them to send me an email if they have a submission idea, something that they would like to submit to be published. Definitely.
It all starts today. Is it up right now?
It's up right now. It's beautiful. A big thanks to the folks at Leap Design for helping us.
Why,
with
there
the
it
look.
Is. The W is the fork.
Yes, it's beautiful.
Isn't that nice?
Isn't it? Isn't
yes.
it lovely?
WFAE. There it is. The little fork is the W. That's very cool. Elizabeth Schaefer, great idea. Thank you for alerting us all to it, and good luck with the blog.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
Thanks.
And thanks to Molly O'Neill and Dan Huntley, our guests today in this segment, and also to Peter Reinhardt, our chef on assignment from Johnson & Wales University. Always fun when you bring these food people in.
Something about food, Mike.
You have to teach me to cook, Peter. You just have to start out.
Well, we've got a book here that we can work with.
I have to buy a pot first, okay?